All right, so I'm Thomas. I'm working in Basel with Eric van Lintegen that you heard this morning. I took over Olin a few years ago, being in charge of running the web part of our lab there. And what I'm going to tell this afternoon is very different from Eric's story this morning. Namely, I'll touch on the stochasticity of gene expression in changing environment and some related evolutionary issue, which is why what we call slacker cell are maintained. All right, I start with a very general introduction, and I think one thing that's that we have learned with molecular biology and genomics is that there is an amazing amount of regulation going on, or interactions at least going on in cellular systems, and this readily poses a question of how this can have evolved. And if you want to start with something simple, you can think, well, microbes, and well, what sort of habitat are they living in? So I was trying to think what I got of the previous week. And well, I certainly got that they live in amazingly diverse places. Like you can find them in water, in soil, in complex, well, multicellular organisms, as microbiota or whatever, foodborne pathogens, sewage water, you name it. And actually, so that certainly represents a number of different environments where you might want to have different lifestyles and different genes, for instance, might be important. But we also know that the condition in these environments can vary dramatically. And well, you can think humidity, temperature, molarity, whatever. And what's that? It's a beaver dying, I guess. Yeah, you can hear the fan not being there. Oh, it's back. Nice. Well, this I could do without a beamer, I guess. Well, yeah. Antibiotics, if you want, whatever. So, very different environments, very different conditions, even in each environment. And we have, I think, a very limited understanding of what are the relevant spatial scales and time scales at which microbes are exposed to these changes. Also, because we don't really know how fast they move from one to the other. Okay, so we don't know much, but we know that the environment is changing. And that's clearly highlighting why it might be very relevant to have regulatory interaction, enable to be able to tune your phenotype to by regulating your gene expression so that you would optimize your reproductive success in the environment where you're sitting. One thing that is remarkable as well is that gene expression regulation varies very much in how tight it can be. It looks like
the kinematic connection issue. Yeah.
I can try with the other adapter, but it looked tight. No, this one won't work.
We got it. No, it works in my sense.
Here we go, and I guess I need to switch that to something else, say one. Yeah, almost there.
Something is coming.
Snap time. Okay. Okay, so nice. I was making the point that regulation can be very tight or can be more sloppy, and that this has a very strong importance. Are you regulated? Okay, we should be set. This really shapes the distribution of phenotypes, and this distribution of phenotypes matter because this is what is seen by selection. So I argue here that if we want to understand how gene regulation has been selected in evolution, we need to understand how population behaviors builds up from individual single cell regulatory responses. And we have put a great deal of And sort of the system we decided to turn to in terms of cell behavior to study that is a very archetypical one. namely the dioxic shift. So you might be, well, you're probably familiar with this curve from monostasis. Well, actually, people remember the glucose lactose, but there was a wide zoo of different sugar mixtures. But you clearly see here that when you grow cell on a mixture of glucose and lactose, they grow exponentially on glucose, and then it slows down during what is called the lag, and then growth regime exponentially. And what we want to do is exactly a similar experiment, but now we want to be able to do that at a single cell level rather than at the population level. So we have put a great deal of effort getting the methods working to do that with a reasonable throughput and good accuracy. So what you see here is a bunch of E. coli cells sitting in microchannels. So in case it's not obvious, each gray bar here is a cell. So this is typically 1 micron wide, 25 micron long, and each of these things is a microfluidic channel. Here you get a large channel with a flow of nutrients. And this wild-type lab strain with the transient fusion of GFP to the beta-galactosidase like Z, so that you see the cell turn green when the lac operon turns gets induced. And so the experimental setup is such that the movie is recorded over 24 hours. We acquire a frame every 3 minutes. And we grow cells first on glucose for 4 hours, then switch them for another 4 hours to lactose and do 3 such cycles. So for the first hours, you see cells growing nicely in glucose. You see the time passing here. So it's now 4, lactose kicks in. You probably saw that all cells are rested, and now most cells are green, also some are still not induced yet, and we are back to glucose, where things get diluted. Things, well, GFP. We do a second switch. Now induction is much more homogeneous over channels, and the experiment goes on.
Is that clock rate? Like, is each one an hour?
Yes. So this is the last lactose thing. All right. Of course, having such a data set is not really useful if you can't extract numbers from it. And this is naturally what we do. So we have developed a software, I'm going to tell you more in a second, where we can extract the lineages. And for each cell observation, a precise length measurement that you see here in white, in a semi-log scale. And also fluorescent measurements, so an estimate of the total fluorescence of the cell that you see in green. And you can already see several things on this plot. First thing, I guess, is that cells are growing nicely exponentially in the glucose phases. Another thing that sort of jumped in your face is that when you switch to lactose, all cells, well, at least these 4 cells stop growing, and you get this plateau here. And then you already see that, and the third thing I wanted to point out, sorry, is that when you go to glucose after being induced, so say this glucose phase or this glucose phase, and I think it's easier to see in this one, you see this nice regime, which is a dilution regime, where at each division, the quantity of GFP, well, there is no more GFP produced, and the quantity of GFP is now halving at each division. All right, so what I'm going to do in this talk is to first tell you some details about how we do that, what are the challenges, and what is available. Then get you through the biology that we think is happening during these glucose-lactose switches, and finally discuss this evolutionary issue that I mentioned in the introduction. So we want to monitor gene regulation in sickle cell, and this poses really two challenges. The first challenge is that we want to monitor growth over long term, or long time scale, and the second is that we want to control the environment. So microfluidic is very well suited for that, and we indeed combine two existing designs into a single chip. One design is a so-called Moser machine, which was developed in the June lab, and has been used by many others since then. The principle, this is what you saw in this previous movie, and the principle is to grow cells in this narrow channel so that they make files and are taken away when they exit this small growth channel. This will allow you to monitor things for over long term without being bothered by exponential growth and cells going out of your field of view and all these kind of stupid details. So that's and the other aspect, which is combined on this chip that you, for which you see the overall structure in the middle, is to be able to control the environment. So we rely on a design proposed by the lab of Jeff Asti, which is called Dial-A-Wave, and which is this unusual junction where two input are split into three channels. And in fact, what the cells see is only the content of the central channel. So that allows you to control with very high time accuracy and also without backflow and really taking care of most usual problems, the environment that the cells see down there in the So I should see. So the, this goes from top to bottom, right? You have your two input controlled by programmable pressure pumps. They are mixed thanks to this design here. Then there is a certain time to let the chemical that you want to mix in case of mixture diffuse. Well, in our case, we do only half switch from glucose to lactose, not relevant. And then down there, you get these roller machine arrays where the cells are trapped. Okay, and we call that, because you need a gimmicky name, a dual input motor machine. The other thing we have developed is a software to analyze this data. Actually, well, we are far from being the first one who want to analyze image data of growing bacteria. But this poses a number of challenges. So roughly, the task you want to achieve is to go from a set of images, usually acquired through time in phase contrast, bright field, and identify cells there. And while possibly having information of fluorescence from other channels acquired in parallel, and you want to reconstruct the lineage and for each time point extract information. So the way this is typically done, and this is taken from a paper by Michael Ovitz and colleagues, who have developed such a software for to analyze growing microcolonies, is that you have a first step where you analyze your phase contrast images to identify the cells, and in a second step, you do a tracking operation to map the cell from one frame to the next, taking into account division events and lysis or cells going out of your field of view and all these kind of things. And well, if you want to analyze fluorescence, then you have to extract it from the other channel, usually based on the mask produced at the segmentation step. Well, this comes with, well, it's very powerful. Many things have been done, but it comes with a few drawbacks, and probably the strongest drawback by far is that segmentation and tracking are completely decoupled. So the error you do at the first step will propagate to the second step. And this is a killer because none of this method works automatically, so it always involves a very large amount of manual correction. And this error propagation makes the manual correction really painful, talking from experience, actually. And another thing that was a problem for us in the case of the mother machine is that most tools available, they can't handle the large displacements that occur close to the exit because cells are pushed by their ancestor. And so really those tools were not working. And also they were paper published with mother machine data. There was no tool available to analyze such image data set. So Eric started a collaboration with a group of Gene Myers and in particular Florian Hugh, the postdoc of Gene, who developed this very nice software, which, to our knowledge, is really the first, probably maybe even in bioimaging in general, where the segmentation and tracking problem is tackled in a single step as a joint operation. So what the software does briefly is that for each step, instead of segmenting cells, it creates a bunch of nested segmentation hypotheses. So here is are your cell, is a sort of intensity profile from which you would create this nested segmentation hypothesis. And then between two consecutive frames, you consider all possible assignments between segment hypotheses. And the software, well, you define a set of constraints, which or of cost functions, sorry, which incorporate your knowledge of the fact that cells tend to grow, that they can divide but not fuse, all these kind of a priori that your brain is using when you look at such movie. Then you tackle this problem as an optimization problem where you want to minimize the cost over the entire data set, so namely all frames. And that works pretty well, and that also comes with a very neat feature when it comes to curation, which is that now the way curation is done is by what we call leverage editing, which consists in forcing manually an additional constraint in your optimization problem, for instance, by saying, well, I know that the true segment here is this one, and that not only will fix the problem you want to polish, but that will usually also fix a bunch of neighboring problems, if any, on adjacent frames. So that's really cool. That was a lot of work, but that works really well. And that indeed, some pre-processing, post-processing is required. That works fairly well. what you see here is to the left, is a fraction of frames that needs to be curated. So you see that in this original data set we analyzed, fairly large, 8 experiments as the one you have seen. Almost half of the gross length didn't need any curation. And you are typically below 1% of the frames that needs to do something. So you need to spend time, but it, at the same time, goes fast. And on the other end, what is nice, we spent quite some additional work to get precise estimates of what we think are relevant physical quantities, namely length and total fluorescence. And you can see here the relative error on length, which is fairly constant, around 3%, on total fluorescence, which is typically between 1 and 5%, 10% if you go to very small number of molecules. All right. I want to tell you one more thing about these methods before moving on to the back, sort of the lactose switch, which is to revisit this very nice calibration that had been proposed by Elovich, Swain, and in this paper by Rosenfeld 10 years ago, which is to solve the problem that you don't, most of the time when you do flow cytometry or microscopy, you don't know the numbers of molecules that are involved or that you are measuring, and you get arbitrary units of your detector. And we have heard, I think, already 20 times this week that numbers matter. We do not disagree. We are interested in going from these arbitrary units of the camera to the numbers of TFT molecules. So the idea behind this calibration is to study the fluctuation of the fluorescent signal that are seen at division. What you know is that when the cell divide, if you look at the fluctuation of the fluorescence between the two daughter cells produced from a single mother, you know that these fluorescents are produced by a finite number of objects, namely the GFP molecules. And so you know what you expect as a distribution, which is binomial distribution with a factor half, parameter half. And so this gives you a particular statistical relationship that you may want to fit, assuming that the number of molecules that you measure is your fluorescent signal times this conversion factor that you are interested in uncovering. So this gives you this equation. And so that was a Rosenfeld thing. And I would probably not even touch it if it was working fine. So I should first say that we realized that our data set with this dilution regime I was briefly mentioning on the first slide is a perfect one to play this game, right? So what you see here is the fluorescence decreasing slowly. This is due to photo bleaching. You can fit it with a single exponential decay. And then for each dividing cell, you extract what we call a triad, which is the mother cell and the two daughter cells. And you can try to infer lambda. When you do that, a sanity check is to check that your lambda is independent of or to stratify your data set by the fluorescence intensity of the mother, and check that your lambda is sort of stable and independent of this intensity. And that was not the case at all. And that worried us quite a lot. And we finally figured out that in our data, at least, the fluctuation in cell size at division are relatively large, typically 2.5%, compared to the binomial fluctuation of due to the partitioning of the fluorescent molecule. So what you have to do is to account for this length bias between the two daughters, which is explaining a relatively large fraction of the bias in fluorescence. And Eric has come up with a very clean Bayesian procedure to do that. And so what you see here on this plot is the posterior of the conversion factor in blue. The estimation that you would get using Rosenfeld method, ignoring this this size variation, is a sort of twofold off. And the dotted line shows you what you get when you stratify by different intensity. What I was saying before, that it was not independent of the motor intensity. All right. So that's all for the method. The last thing I want to say is that the things we have developed are publicly available. So you have very extensive description, Cat5 available. You can even order directly microfluidics master from our mask on this open repository for microfluidics system. And the software is open source on GitHub and has been packaged as a Fiji plugin to make user life easier. And we have already run a workshop to introduce interested people to it, and probably do so again in the future. Okay, so now it's time to move on to this glucose-lactose switch I introduced in at first. And the first thing I want to highlight to describe what we see in this experiment is that also we think there is a fair amount of stochasticity going on in gene expression in this system. There are also a number of features which are highly deterministic. And I will highlight three of those. So the first one is that when you do the first switch from glucose to lactose, and the cells are, we call them naive, as I said before, they all stop growing very reproducibly. The second important point is that if you look at when the growth restart, it coincides very well with the onset of the GFP signal becoming detectable. And we typically take a threshold at 100 or 200 GFP molecules to call it a detectable signal. And another remarkable feature of this growth restart after the lag is that the cells look like they restart growing exponentially almost at full rate. I think it's very clear here that this cell has really a profile which is flat and that linear here. Well, sorry, but this is not in semi-log, so I guess this one would be a better example, where it's probably already exponential from the beginning.
But the cells are not straight in linear scale. Is that okay? Is that to be expected?
Well, which one, sorry, is the fact that this one is straight?
Yeah, almost all lines are zero.
Are you talking of the restart, or are you talking of the general profile when they grow in lactose?
In lactose and glucose, the black lines are straight.
Okay, so the black lines are on a semi-log scale, right? This is length. So you expect, seeing it straight line means that the growth is exponential. But you get a point that if the concentration was constant in lactose, you would also expect to have an exponential profile for the fluorescence. And this we don't see. We see traces which are very variable. I think this is a perfect example, right?
Yeah.
So they do not follow. Well, they are not better described by linear or exponential shells. This is a statement I can make. Yeah.
The lineage is represented with a dotted line.
Yeah, so I didn't tell you all the details here. So this shows you the bottom cell. This is the cell at the first position on top of the bottom cell, the second and third position. And every time the cell divides, so when a bottom cell divides, you will get one cell here and one cell there. When this cell divides, the two daughters are going to end up there and there because they are pushed up by the division of this one, etc. So yes, it's showing you the lineage. And to quantify what I was saying, that the growth restart at the full rate, we have done a few more analyses, and so you can, so now you can stratify the traces by how much time has gone since the lock operon has turned on, and estimate the instantaneous growth rate, the distribution of instantaneous growth rate for all cells in your data set. And you see that, well, it tends to accelerate a bit, but it's certainly not starting from zero. And already at the end, yeah, I should say the dotted line is average growth rate in lactose, so or median growth rate in lactose. And yeah, so you see that already at the start, several cells are growing as fast as cells which are fully induced in lactose. And this really raises, and what's important to realize here is that those cells have a tiny, tiny amount of like this GFP, right? So this raises a question for which we have no answer at the moment, which is why is LACZ expressed at such a high level at full induction if you can already grow at full speed when
you start. Is this part just the first lactose phase, or is it?
This is for the first lactose phase, yeah. So
I mean, it looks super different, and it like over there, what you're saying, immediate growth arrest, and all cells at first switch to lactose. That's what it looked like over there.
Okay, I guess I was not clear. This is not from the switch to lactose. This is each cell is now a line from the time when the green line start to raise. Right, so this is to estimate whether when they restart growing, they restart exponentially at full speed, or they restart slower and would accelerate.
Sorry for the confusion.
And the third deterministic thing that is clear here is that when we switch back to lactose, the lac operon is shut off very reproducibly. I like it here, and saying you can measure the distribution of times to cut off the lac operon, it would look like that. You see that in typically 10, 15 minutes, which in fact correspond also to the maturation of the GFP, so might simply be the time to finish maturing GFPs that were produced when you were still in lactose. Okay, so that takes us to what we think is the main stochastic feature of this regulatory system, which is how much time the cell wait before turning on, so to speak. And here I really focus on the first switch only. So for each cell, we measure the duration until, again, in this analysis I take a criteria which is based on detecting some signal on the GFP channel, and I can measure this parameter for each cell and plot the distribution, and you see the distribution to the left, to the right. The very striking feature is that, well, first this distribution is broad, right? It's spanning roughly between 30 minutes or 25 minutes and 3 hours. And the second thing is that this distribution is multimodal with at least three peaks. So the first peak being very fast cells, which get induced in less than 50 minutes, so typically 20 to 45 minutes. This is a quarter of the population. Then there are two-thirds of the population that spend between 1 and 3 hours to turn on. And then, and you cannot see them on this plot because there would be sort of a peak here, and I'll tell you more about those at the end. There are about 10% of the cells that will not get induced at all during the 4 hours. So the first thing we wanted to check when we saw that, or that came to our mind, is that, well, it would be very interesting to be able to relate how much time a cell spent before starting growing with its cell state at the time of the switch. And we went for classical variables that people have proposed should control this delay. So one is the initial LACZ GFP level. As you see, there is no correlation. Same, the initial growth rate has absolutely zero correlation with the lag, and also the cell cycle phase shows no correlation. And I've checked a few more. I'm happy if you have some suggestion, but we have not found any such physiological variable that could explain this distribution of induction lag. So puzzled, and probably even more puzzled by an observation, the next observation, which is that when a cell gets induced in a channel, it's much more likely now that other cells in this channel are going to get induced than cells in the neighboring channels, which, to put it in a slightly more quantitative way, means that cells which are related have highly correlated lags. So we quantify this correlation for different level of relatedness. So you can tell cells which have been divided once since they share the common ancestor, we call them sister. You are at 85% R squared, first cousin, second cousin. So you now have to go back 3 division to find a common ancestor, and you still have 50% of variance explained by the lag of the other cell. This is to give you an idea of how striking this is. I show here a plot of other variables that you expect to correlate very much. Typically, things like length at birth. So you see that length at birth between sister is not more correlated than 50%, or the concentration of DFP at birth is like at 65 or 70%. But there is, well, first, nothing which is as high for sisters, and also nothing that lasts so long over several divisions.
Have you done the same experiment labeling the repressor?
Nope. I know, well, I'm going to come to that. We have more indirect proof. I know several people have proposed what sort of control this irritability pattern would be, the level of lag I and fluctuation of the level of lag I. It would be a very tough experiment because you have typically 10 lag I per cell, right? So with our experimental skills at the moment, we can't really do that. And I'm not even sure anybody could with the sort of in vivo tracking we require to also see the lag at the end. It would be very likely to kill them. I'll tell you what is our best interpretation for this observation at the moment. To make them maybe easier to follow, here is a small reminder of how the lag operand is thought to be regulated. So the lag operand is a series of 3 genes. In our case, LAGZ is fused with a GFP. So LAGZ is producing this galactosidase, which has 2 activity, LAGZ, LAGY, LAGA. We'll skip LAGA. There are no very clear function attributed to it. LAGY has a clear function. It's a membrane protein, and it's importing lactose and other related molecules, but it's very specific. Then LAGZ is a galactosidase, which has 2 activity. The activity which is most well known is that it's degrading lactose to glucose plus galactose, then used by catabolism. There is another important activity for the regulation, which is that galactosidase is catalyzing the isomerization of lactose to allolactose. And this matters because the things that interact with LACI, which is the transcription factor that controls the expression of this operand, is not lactose itself, it's allolactose. So when there is no lactose available, LACI is active, it represses the activity, and no expression can happen. Now when there is lactose available, sort of this pathway is activated, and the repressor is inactivated by the interaction with allolactose. So this raises, it's a whole puzzle, but which is how do you start, right? Because it's known that cells which do not have LACY really can't get induced. So how do you start when lactose comes in the media, if you have none of these, to kickstart the positive feedback and start relieving the inhibition by LACI? So what has been proposed and what we actually think happened in our experiment is that some spontaneous expression of the lac operon can occur even in absence of lactose, just because the repression by the lac I is not complete. And our interpretation for our data is that the cell with a short lag are cells which have one or more molecule of lac Z and lac Y present that have been produced by a stochastic burst of expression of the lac operon. Having this few lac Y molecule allow lactose to come in, few lac Z to make allolactose, and this again kickstarts a positive feedback. And then this short delay we see, 20 to 45 minutes, it's the time it takes to sort of build up this metabolite and accumulate enough lac Z GFP and maturate GFP and start seeing the signal. On the contrary, the cells which have a long lag, we think are cells which have lost all permease and galactosidase since the last burst. And so they can't import, they are completely impermeable to lac Y, and they have to wait for a stochastic burst of lac operon expression to start inducing the regulatory system. So this interpretation comes with a number of predictions, and I'll try to convince you we have support for those. So the two first predictions are that the fraction of cells with long lags should match the fraction of cells which have no lac Y or no lac Z when they grow in glucose. And luckily, these experiments have been done by others, in particular, extensively by the lab of Sunishi. They have two papers in 2006-2008. And they, depending on which reporter they use, they find that 50 to 65% of cells have zero lac Z or lac Y. You see the distribution. You see here the distribution for lac Z. So that matches very well our two-thirds of cells having long lags. And the second prediction that comes with this number is that the presence absence of the lac expression should correlate over 2-3 generations. And this is what we see when we look at the heritability data.
You didn't show it happens over more than that, did you?
More
generations, three, third cousins.
Yeah, we don't have those, right? Because we have only 5 to 8 cells in a channel.
Okay. So, yeah.
And if we were to have a longer channel, then we would start to really have problems with diffusion and these kind of things. Two more predictions. One is how much time it should take you to completely lose a memory. So at steady state, we have experiments where we run the cell in lactose only for 24 hours. And we know that they have typically about 6,000 molecules of lac Z. if you play the game, if you simulate how much time this would take to just lose by random partitioning at our division rate, this gives you a 16 to 22 hours estimate of how much time it takes to completely lose the memory. So I've done a subsequent series of experiments where now I don't switch every 4 hours, but I give them a first 4 hours in glucose, 4 hours in lactose, and then I study a variable time until I switch them again to lactose. To lactose, yes. You can't really read here, I'm sorry. This is 4, 6, 12, 16, 20, 4, 24. So the red dashed line is the distribution you have seen before, this bimodal distribution. It's for naive cells. And you see that at the second switch, at 4 and 6 hours, you are much faster. And it typically, well, the data is not extremely clean, but it typically takes 20 to 24 hours to recover, to completely lose the memory and recover the distribution of naive cells. So this goes, this supports fairly well this prediction. And the last thing, which is maybe the most solid piece of evidence and that really goes to your question, is we were thinking, okay, what we really want to do is to be able to manipulate the level of lac I so that we change the frequency of the stochastic burst that happen in glucose, right? But again, you have only 10 lac I, it's really tricky to manipulate that at the genetic level. So what we did instead is to use this lactose analog that is able to enter the cell without permease and is binding to lac I with very high affinity. And instead of using it to induce the cell, we use it at very low concentration to sort of titrate a small fraction of the lacci. And what the expectation is that when you do that, you should express the frequency at which those bursts happen. So again here, the red distribution is the distribution of naive cell you've seen before without IPTG. When you now add 1 micromolar of IPTG, you lose cells in these very long tails, and now all switch in less than 1.5 hours. And you see that the two first modes are more populated. And if you are at 5 micromolar IPTG, almost all cells will switch, will move to the fast mode. And I should say that at this level of IPTG, of course, cells are not induced without adding lactose or more IPTG.
What's the evidence that the IPTG doesn't come in through the permease? I always thought it did.
It does. But it does also come in without the permease. This is what matters here.
TMG comes through the permease, and it's the famous maintenance.
So TMG will not enter if you don't have a permease. IPTG will enter without a permease, and you are right, it will enter faster if you have a permease.
But do you still get the ones that are not in with the IPTG? You're still getting a minority that are not. Not responding.
You
have the IPTG.
That's a good question. I don't remember. I think it's slower, but I don't remember. And I don't have the data plotted because I checked before. I can check for you. You mean these 5-10% that do not get induced, right? Yeah. I don't know.
Also, according to your mechanism, shouldn't the long population go away if you just express the permease constitutively?
I'll touch on that.
I see.
Okay. So this is a mechanism we think. Well, at the moment, this is the best mechanism we can think of. We have other experiments in mind to keep challenging it. But the next, the third thing I wanted to present you is discussing this question of which sort of selective process can result in such large distribution of induction time, right? Because it really means that small fraction of cells will get induced very late. So we call these slacker cells, these cells that will wake up late or will not wake up at all. And as you have seen before, we have only a quarter that is fast, and the majority of the population that is slower. So in order to get a sense for this question, it's important to, to look at how the population, total population growth depends on the distribution of single cell lags. And this is what Eric has done here. So if you take a distribution of lag times, which is not so far from what we have experimentally, and it's important to highlight that the distribution of lag time is here plotted in terms of number of doublings when the cell grow, and that this is spanning several doublings. once a cell wake up at time t, it will grow exponentially, and the equivalent growth is going to be how many cells will be produced is just the classical exponential growth equation accounting for this delay that the cell has started growing later. And if you now look at the total population growth with this distribution of lags, it follows this weighted average. So this is the total growth if you have no lags. And this is, if you want, the average delay that you get for a given distribution of lag. So now you can ask the question of how much cells that wake up late contribute to the total number of cells. So if you take the cells that wake up after 2 here, and they represent something like a bit more than 3/4 of the population, they will only contribute at the end a half of the total population, what you see here on this log scale. This small shift here corresponds to 50%. Now, if you take that cell that wake up after 4 division, then it will be only 1%, and you can keep growing. So this is more or less a parallel tail, as far as I remember. And the slowest 10% of the cell that start here, so this small triangle is long enough that it makes 10%, but they contribute almost nothing. And this is an important point here, is that the cells that wake up late, they are exponentially lost, so to speak, or out-competed by the cells that have woken up early. And we think that there is an interesting analogy with the evolutionary theory of aging and the notion of a shadow of selection. What do I mean with that? In the case of aging, and well, the question evolutionary theory of aging is how can you select for the sort of longevity pattern which are observed.
Question before you talk about
sure.
That. So it seems like the argument you just made works if these cells are typically in reasonably large populations sharing the same environment. It's almost like a kin selection argument. That if each cell is infinitely far apart, inhabiting a separate environment, cells which in their environment are represented by a cell with a very long leg will never do anything useful.
That's correct.
And so then it hurts them enormously. And so one argument you could make from this is that when E. coli encounters lactose, it typically does so in situations where there are lots and lots of cells, which is exactly what happens in the mammalian gut when people drink milk and stuff like that. And so it sort of fits the ecology of the situation where the cells encounter the sugar.
Yeah, well, we are also, actually, there is a grad student in the lab who is exactly looking at the sort of dynamics you're mentioning and looking at how this distribution of flags will be selected depending on the size of the inoculum and when it's more advantageous to rather sense the environment and when it's going to be more selected to be diverse, so to speak. So here, for the argument I want to make, we are indeed thinking in terms of large enough populations. You're totally correct. So the question is, why on earth would you select for aging, or not counter select for aging? And well, this has been an old question, which has been nicely addressed by Medawar in the late 40s. Sorry, and the idea the way I like to think of it is that in the natural habitat, this is really designed for I guess mammals and higher organisms, but in the natural habitat the survival is constrained by extrinsic mortality. So it sort of shit happens, you get killed, you get predator eating you, whatever, but you are and this sort of these processes constrain your survival, and this is what is going to set the level of maintenance and maintenance that will be selected, so that you can be sure to reach an age where you are still likely to survive, but your level of maintenance is not going to be selected that you can live much longer. So now, if you look at these organisms in a protected environment without extrinsic mortality, you start seeing the survival having a completely different shape, where as long as the maintenance works, so to speak, the survival is very high, and then you get this typical decline. And so this is what has been coined as a selection shadow, because it also means that those genes which are detrimental late in life, when you are very unlikely in your natural environment and when you are under selection to still be alive, if they are beneficial enough early on, can be selected. So this is really the idea of this selection shadow. And there are a number of analogies with the selection of slacker cells. First, the contribution of the slacker cell is exponentially lost as they wake up later. similarly, the selection only cares about the growth of the fastest responding cells. And so you can make a similar argument that mutations that will increase growth of fast responder, even at the cost of populating more the tail of slow responder, might be selected if they increase the average growth of the cell in this changing environment. That's more or less it. I wanted to just, yeah, okay, so this is the summary. I've presented a publicly available setup that is both incorporating the experimental and computational tool to track quantitatively the gene regulation in single cell. Using this glucose-lactose regulatory system, I've shown you that the distribution of the induction lag is a very stochastic variable, which is multimodal, explain why we think that it depends on whether you have zero or non-zero lag expression before the switch. And finally, I've introduced why the selection against non-responding cells is exponentially suppressed with this selection shadow analogy. Yes, I wanted to go back a tiny bit to this thing for which we don't really have an explanation at the moment, and this is going to touch both Bruce's question and your question on LACY. So you see here several independent experiments where you see the distribution for naive. So you can forget first for this long tail. So on the left part of the plot, you see several experiments. Each line is an experiment, and you see that after, so this is a distribution of induction lag. And at 4 hours, you see that in all experiments, there is always a small proportion of cells between, well, say 1 or 2%, but typically 5 to 12%, or to 8%, whatever, which have not woken up. So it's very variable, and honestly, I don't know why, but it's also almost always there. So this pushed me to do another experiment where instead of leaving them 4 hours, I would leave them 30 hours to see the shape of the tail of the distribution. Well, so, okay, n equal 1, but at least in the experiment, at the end, there were still many cells, and here the population, well, I have a sample which is 2 times larger than for other experiments. I still have several cells which have not woken up. An interesting feature is that when you focus on these cells here which are stuck, and you ask whether they were growing before and whether they will grow after when you switch back to lactose, you get this sort of table. So this tells you the growth before and the growth after, this meaning in the preceding glucose episode and the consecutive one. So, of course, you get some cells which are sort of dead or not growing. But the striking number is this one, that you see that close to 3/4 are growing fine before, fine after, but will not be able to induce in 4 hours. So we don't know yet what's going on there.
You don't know how those numbers look for the ones at the very end? After longer than 4 hours?
The one at the very...
If you go for longer than 4 hours?
In lactose, you mean?
Yeah.
So I have only one experiment where I go for longer than 4 hours in lactose. It's this one. The other one I was going for more than four... The one I was showing with the memory, I was going with more than 4 hours, but only in glucose. Because I wanted to sort of...
And with this one, did you put it in glucose again at the end?
No, I didn't. Okay. Because it's... Actually, with 6 hours of glucose before, it's already 36 hours, and it's experimentally challenging to go longer.
The ones not growing have an advantage in the other medium over those ones that have been growing in the previous one.
It's hard to tell, but having an advantage in terms of growing faster,
yeah.
No. This is clear, no, because there are actually many which are, when I say growth, I have a very... liberal growing criteria, something like 0.15 doubling per hour or something like that. So even if you grow, as long as you have an exponential profile, even if you grow very slow, I call you growing. and there is a sizable fraction which is growing slower than the average. So there tend to be cells which are sort of a bit.
I have a technical question about that. So you have a certain number of cells in your channel, mm-hmm. and you're trying to follow the ones that aren't growing, but aren't the ones that don't grow actually getting pushed out at the top of the channel frequently?
So these ones are typically cells at the bottom. Not only, but it's you are completely correct that most of the time, if you're very close to the top, you'll be pushed out.
Okay, so you're losing a lot of
potentially non-growing cell, yes.
Yeah, so you're having to mostly focus on the original mother cell at the bottom, I guess.
Yes, I think it's here. I think half of those cells, or a bit more, are at the bottom, and I guess the other half is almost exclusively the second cell from the bottom, something like that. Yeah.
But you know that I will argue
yes.
that the uninduced cells, by being they help the one above it to become induced, right? Because the one at the bottom is the old, has the old pole, right? So the one above it has a new pole, and they will have a better induction rate.
Yeah, it's possible. So there is, I was checking again, actually, because I was almost sure that an argument would pop up. There is very little effect of pole age on all what I've presented. This is one of the very rare thing I actually, I had forgotten it, but I checked it again yesterday on this uninduced, I've done one experiment because I had also this pole age issue in mind. I've done one experiment where instead of doing the switch to lactose after 4 hours, I do it after 24 hours. Because when I do it after 4 hours, typically the pole age is 3, 4, 5, something like that, not more. When I do that, the profile of the distribution of induction lag is almost similar. But the thing that changes is that in this experiment, I have 20% of cells which do not get induced. So that would go in your direction. But again, I had sort of forgotten it, so I have to go back to it. And this is the kind, I'm very puzzled by the fact that this variable is fluctuating so much here, the fraction of uninduced, and I don't know why. So it also means, well, which comes with the fact that if you want to make a statement, you probably need to do many experiments, and it's not so easy. All right. So one observation we have done, and that's coming to the comment of whether we could overexpress LACY. Constitutively expressed like Y or like Z. So we thought actually that might explain, well, that was before we had this interpretation instead of having zero or more like molecules, but we thought that might help us understand what these modes are. And so we have done an experiment where we take the same strain with a LACZ GFP reporter on the chromosome, and then from a plasmid, we constitutively express either LACZ or LACY at a level which is close to full induction in lactose.
Can I just ask one more question?
Sure.
Did you pick that line to run longer because it had the most that had not started growing? No. It's just an accident.
It's just an accident.
Okay.
I don't have such level of control. When the experiment's running, I don't know where I am, right? This is all the analysis done offline.
That's funny.
Yeah, that's...
Okay.
I don't know why.
Okay.
You're dealing with two things. You're dealing with catabolite repression as well as the lac operon as well.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you did this experiment with, say, constitutives, and you switched, are you going to get that distribution in?
The constitutive, like I delete, or...?
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's not just the lac operon that's going from glucose to galactose, or glucose to lactose.
So the other sensor is that I don't really know what's going on with catabolite repression in this system, because we are in this sort of fairly unusual setup where you really have an off switch from one to another. So sort of as soon as you start seeing lactose, all glucose is gone. So all the story with the ADP production with the import of glucose, etc., it cannot really hold because this thing is not happening anymore. So, but where what I really would like to do, and I'm very much welcoming a suggestion, would be to do a switch from a condition where they would not be growing on glucose, but on some metabolite where catabolite repression should be very low. And to see what the distribution would look like if I would go, for instance, from glycerol or something like that to lactose, to see whether in a condition where we, it's even less likely that catabolite repression is playing a role, the distribution would be the same. That's the best I think of at the moment. But again, suggestions are welcome.
But in your analogy with metawars trying to argue for the evolution of genetic senescence, a genetic, you know, why the likelihood of survival declines as you age. Mm-hmm. You know, this is all phenotypic, presumably. I mean, the ones that are not growing are genetically identical to those that...
You know, yeah. No, but I was discussing how come that you select a genetic system in which the distribution of phenotype is such, right? But of course, the selection here was... there was some selection happening in the past that has shaped this distribution of lag times that we characterize. This is what I'm talking about. I agree.
I don't think that necessarily the distribution of lag times was under any selection. It's just...
Yeah, well, then this comes to Andrew's question.
Exactly. Yeah. If the population was super fragmented, trust me, the distribution would not look like this.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I would bet so, yes.
You have to wait until tomorrow.
Okay. Okay, so I'm trying to finish. So this thing here, we constitutively express one of the other, and we made a... puzzling observation, but it might maybe explain this small fraction of stuck cell. Maybe we start with a... Okay, we can start with a... No, let's start with a plot. So, and I really want you to focus on these three columns. Sorry, this is not really polished, again from a lab meeting. This is a strain that I've been talking about for the last hour. So with this lactate reporter and no plasmid. This is the same strain now with the plasmid constitutively expressing lac Z, and this is the same strain with the plasmid constitutively expressing lac Y. And you see them growing in M9 glucose plus IPTG and M9 lactose, and so which are the conditions I use for the switch. And the very impressive observation I find is that the growth is terribly reduced. So first you see that there is a small cost to this translational fusion of lac Z GFP, because in lactose you grow a bit less well than if you have a native allele of lac Z. Well, fine. But now if you constitutively express lac Z, so you get more of this enzyme, my naive expectation was that you should be better off, and I would rather expect you to go back to native level. And in fact, you grow extremely poorly. If you look at what the fluorescence of the cell look like, so this is a mixture of lac Z and lac Y, and there is no such effect of lac Y. So this is a mixture of cells with lac Z and lac Y. So you'll see some cells turn on their GFP, and those cells that turn on their GFP, I can tell you from other experiments that they must have the lac Y constitutive expression. So these three growth lanes, they have the lac Y, and the other must have the lac Z. And I say that because when I plate cells, I see growing in M9 lactose, I see all cells being fluorescent with a lac-Y constitutive expression and all cells being dark with a lac-Z constitutive expression. And now the striking feature is that we are at 20 hours and there has not been a single division of the cell constitutively expressing lac-Z. So this is telling that when you change the balance of the component of the operon, you sort of lock off the cell in a state which is probably completely unusual, and completely disrupt the possibility to grow. So I have a hard time imagining how you can be unbalanced and stay unbalanced for such a long time with the sort of mechanism we hypothesize of stochastic bursts, because normally you should still get some protein to degrade and get the next burst to come, etc. So it's a bit hard to... But at the moment, that's sort of the closest we have seen to preventing growth based on this lac regulation. Yep. The last slide, and this one is really the last slide, is what I'm planning to do with a nice student here during the summer course. So because the topic is community, and there are not that many community you can look at in the mother machine, I propose to study the interaction of E. coli with phages, and I picked Lambda. Lanning Zhang, from postdoc of Golding, now assistant professor, was kind enough to send both fluorescent phages and a reporter of lysogenic activity on a plasmid, so that we have these strains that you see on these pictures. And the hope is that we will be able to see in the mother machine the same phage happening as a diffraction limited fluorescent spots, and then be able to monitor the outcome of the infection, either seeing the cells become green or becoming lysogenic. And well, I find it very relevant to do that in the mother machine, because all experiments that have been done so far have been done by infecting bacteria before starting the experiment. So basically, people have no idea of the life history trait of the bacteria that are infected, and it's not really possible to correlate the outcome of the infection with the trait of, with the state of the cell. So that's, well, we'll give it a shot. If you have any experience with preparing lambda lysates, or this trigger any interest for you, you're very welcome to come and discuss or have a look at the microscope. And yeah, I'd like to thank Eric, of course, Matthias, who was a PhD student who developed the chip and started the collaboration on image analysis and did the first experiments on this glucose lactose project, all at, with Olin at the time. Atos, who is working on this selection of lact distributions, and Florian and Jean at MPI Dresden for this collaboration on the software. Thank you.
Ones that aren't responding as individual cells. I mean, you certainly expect a distribution. Why are you getting those that are not responding at all? And then you move them into glucose.
Well, okay, I don't know. Well, when we try to think about it, or sort of the way we like to think about it with Eric, is that you, as you grow, you are sort of exploring your metabolic space of your protein, of your proteome, right? Having certain quantity of each possible protein in your genome, and that will define your physiological state. And it might be that you catch them at a point where they are just unable to cope with this new challenge, or with this new, not able to kickstart this regulation, for instance. And then now you let them grow again. Yeah, because I didn't say that, but we have weak evidence that these cells, which are stuck when they restart growing in glucose and you switch them a second time to lactose, this time they'll, of course, it's a very small sample now, but this small sample, there is some evidence that the cell switch. So yeah, it might be that the first time you you catch them in a physiological state where they are just by chance unable to handle it, and the next time you catch them somewhere else because they have moved a bit by growing. And but I, as I said, I have no solid explanation.
An analogy, because it's in my head, you know, with the phenomenon of persistence. Mm-hmm. You get this minority of cells that a culture would say gentamicin, bring it down from 10 to the 7, down to 10 to the 3, yep. And those cells just persist, and then you grow them up again. So it's clearly phenotypic. And Natalie Balaban suggests that it's basically non-growing cells that just, you know, the phenomenon is the same. We're getting this heterogeneity in the population.
Yeah, but the difference is that in Balaban's paper, most of the cells were not growing when you eat them, right?
Right.
They don't have that many cells. And it's, we, you are also talking something like 10 to the minus 4. I'm talking 5%.
We know about them because they plate. You take them out of the antibiotic. You're doing it by plating, so they're forming colonies. So they're perfectly okay. Yeah. It's just that they just weren't killed, even though there was plenty of medium around. So, I mean, you're just dealing with all this phenotypic heterogeneity and theoretically, genetically homogeneous population. I just don't understand.
Well, if you're right that like maybe lack of eye is important, and you're saying there's only 10 copies of protein in the cell, it's very hard to hit 10 on the nose. If that's important, you'd expect a huge amount of phenotypic heterogeneity, so that could give you right eye fraction.
Yeah, but again, any arguments that would be based on sort of having small number fluctuations or unbalance or whatever, how would that be stable for dozens of hours?
But how is it normally reset? Is it diluted out by growth?
That's one option, right?
Right. Exactly. I mean, it's not degraded.
Yeah, normally you dilute them. Exactly.
Yeah,
but that's gone.
Then the question would be why? Yeah. So wait a minute. If that's gone, right? So you can't erase over a too high level of lack of eye, throws them in, right? You're not growing, so you can't dilute, so you're stuck.
Yeah. Okay. But then we go to arguments where nobody has any idea of the stability of lack of eye in vivo, right? Is the half-life 6 hours, 12 hours, 4 days? Who knows?
If it's
4 days, you're right. If it's 6 hours, it doesn't hold.
Okay. And those would be totally reasonable ranges for it. I don't know.
Proteins, I don't know. GFP is very stable, but I don't know for like...
I mean, clearly they're stuck into something, but I mean, my impression is that as long as you're growing and diluting and expressing,
right,
you're sort of sampling the space of stochastic gene expression. The moment you stop growing, your rate at which you're sampling new state goes down a lot.
Right.
And it doesn't go to zero,
right,
but you really slow down a lot. And so maybe if you find yourself in a bad state, it can take a very long time and you can be stuck in it. That's my...
But if I understand right, that there's kind of an asymmetry where if you're in a bad state because you have too little of something, your expression maybe doesn't go down that much, or your chance of expression doesn't go down that much, so you expect not to get stuck, or if you're in a fast state of having too much of something, you're more likely to get stuck.
You also get stuck because you have to wait for a little pop, a little burst of expression.
And expression just can be really down-regulated in general when you're growth arrested?
Well, that's the thing I didn't touch, but people after that's actually one hypothesis we had for some time. Don't know how to challenge it, but some people have proposed that, have weak evidences that the stationary phase regulator, or POS, is upregulated during this growth arrest in lactose. So it might also be something that you start completely changing your metabolism, and that would sort of push you even further to something less and less state. So maybe the longer you wait, the less likely you become to be able to jump out. I don't know.
The rate of transcription and translation goes down. The promoter being unoccupied by repressor briefly will be less consequential.
Mm-hmm.
So how general are these bursts? I think it's interesting. My naive expectation would have been that I have a leakage, that still a little bit of expression. But now you're postulating that bursts where you basically have your expression going on. So how typical is this? Is there anything known about this?
I guess I can understand the question in two ways. It's like, how would other genetic system compare to that one, or how would different strains of E. coli sample from like the one Eric was talking this morning would behave? So this is one thing we would like to do, to look a bit at this distribution of lags in these natural isolates. I would start addressing your question. For other systems, I don't really know well.
But other genes,
all gene expression is bursty, right?
Maybe it's important to know that in E. coli, most genes, the number of mRNAs per cell
is very low.
Is below one. Mm-hmm. So that means that they're sitting around most of the time with no mRNAs. Every once in a while, you spit two mRNAs out, you make some proteins from it.
Within it's like two mRNAs are bursts.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's a small one, then you make a few hundred proteins from it, 100 proteins from it. They're gone again, these mRNAs, and now you have to wait another hour before you get the next.
So you're basically saying the bursts are compatible with my leakage idea. It's basically the same thing. It's just the numbers are so small that...
Yeah. And you should think of your leakage as something that has fairly large fluctuations.
And the whole lack operon is set up so that the repressor can only dissociate very briefly because there's a second binding site that prevents the repressor from ever getting used in that way. Like a lot of stuff is understood.
So, but this will make them more susceptible for these bursts or another gene?
No, it means the bursts are guaranteed to be extremely short. Because the repressor rebinds again very quickly. But it can't physically escape the diffusion rate.
Hey, thanks.